Today is Tuesday, October 3rd, 2012. Sorry, 2020. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Richard Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N. My name is Tom Martin, and good morning, Richard. How are you today?
Good morning. Doing good.
Good. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. We'd wrapped up the last interview in 1970, 71, 72 time period, where you're going between the Bay Area and Mexico with a wonderful woman named Catherine. And I looked up the Stoneman Meadows riots in Yosemite that happened on the 4th of July over a series of a couple days in 1970. Do you remember that? Were you there, and do you remember what happened?
Yeah, I do remember that. Initially, I thought it was a year or so later. What I remember about it is that whole year was, I think People's Park was in 69, and I was very active there. And Stoneman, I probably returned to Yosemite, San Francisco area. My normal pattern would have been getting back to the States around April or May.
Okay.
And I told you about the Snow Creek cabin, right?
Yeah.
With the Curry Company.
Yeah.
And so I make that as kind of my base. And I remember being down in the valley. Probably for 4 or 5 days preceding the riots. And to me, it was just another example of law and order. It seemed like the meadow was clean. It seemed like people were taking care of it. It seemed just like people wanted to have some fun, that they weren't really doing any harm to the valley. And then I remember they put a day or two before the horses rode in, they put a curfew on people going into the meadow. Had to be out at a kind of an unrealistic time of day. And I don't think anybody there, just like at People's Park, nobody there was looking to start a fight. You know, the same similarity as the People's Park is, man, it's just a bunch of hippies out here wanting to, put a garden in, right? Mm-hmm. An abandoned friggin' lot. And, you know, the authorities, the cops, Ronald Reagan was governor, Nixon was president. And they weren't having any of that. And so just like People's Park, they just had to show their power and and they had to do it with force. And I guess, I've never read the history of it, but I think the park, it wasn't just park rangers. They had brought in U.S. Marshals. They had brought in county sheriffs. They had brought in, just like they do today for Black Lives Matter, they just bring a whole bunch of people in and charge, you know?
Mm, yeah.
And so I remember, I don't remember the exact time, but I remember seeing the horses and remember maybe, 300, 400, 500 people in the meadow.
Okay.
You would know better than I. And I kind of realized what exactly was going to happen. And when they started coming in, I kind of backed out. I wasn't ready for a fight in a place that had given me so much comfort.
Yeah, wow.
You
really?
Know, if I would have been in Berkeley or Santa Barbara or Oakland and they were rolling in on horses, well, you know, I would have been on the front lines. But I remember when it first started and I could see the panic, I kind of slipped into some trees and I started the hike back up to Snow Creek Cabin.
Hmm.
And so the details of the 2, 3, 4 hours of violence and all the arrests and all of that, I don't have. What I do have is, like I say, the feeling that, man, this is fucked.
Yeah.
You know, this place, man, I love this place, and it's turning into something just like you would find in Berkeley.
Hmm.
And then I stayed up at the cabin for 2 or 3 days. I didn't go back into the valley. And I hiked out to Tioga Road, and I think they had closed the whole park down because there was absolutely no traffic. There was nothing going on. So, you know, I was relying on hitchhiking.
Yeah,
I was gonna head back to the city for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no traffic, there was no nothing, so I dropped back into the cabin and stayed there for a couple of 3 days, and pretty much the same thing when I walked out to the valley. I think they were still shut down, and I got hassled a little bit, and I just said, no, shoot, man, no, I've been backcountry for the last week, you know?
Mm-hmm. Which is true, that's what you were doing.
Yeah, that's what I was doing. So it was just another, I don't know how to say it. It was awakening for me. Like I say, it was happening in a place that I'd loved and that had brought me calmness and peace.
Hmm.
And so it really disappointed me. The guy, I could have sworn it was 71 or 72, but it makes sense now as far as my timeline is when I went to Idaho and all of that.
So the superintendent at the time was a man named Leslie Arnberger.
Right.
And his son, Rob Arnberger, would become superintendent of Grand Canyon National Park a couple decades later. Did you ever meet Leslie Arnberger?
No, I never did.
Okay.
The guy that was there when I first moved to Grand Canyon was Bruce Shaw. And he had been assistant superintendent. I think Arnberger had moved on. I think he had been the superintendent. Bruce was the assistant, but Bruce was acting as superintendent when I was there.
Okay.
Now, was Dick Marks the chief ranger at Yosemite at that time?
Yes.
Okay, he was the chief ranger. That's what I thought.
You ever have any words with Dick Marks later when he was superintendent at Grand Canyon about the event, or did that topic never come up between you two?
Really never came up where we talked about it,
okay.
But I think we each knew that the other was there and on opposing sides.
Okay.
And he, Yeah, he was a piece of work. He reminded me of my father.
Ah, okay. Well, when we get you to Grand Canyon and Superintendent Marks is there, I'll ask you for Superintendent Marks stories.
Okay. I got one or two.
Okay. So it sounds in a way like you're really lucky to be able to size up that situation and then retreat back to your sanctuary.
Yeah, I was. I just could not imagine myself fighting and rioting in a place like that.
Yeah.
You know, from going to, you know, beating on a Congo drum and having a little smoke and being real mellow to all of a sudden a cavalry charge, just didn't feel right.
Yeah. So moving forward then, 71, 72, you mentioned Idaho. Did that kind of get you out of your cycle of going to Mexico in the winter and in the Bay Area in the summer up in the Yosemite country?
Yeah, and I'd have to get the dates exact right. What really moved me out of my cycle of Yosemite, and it was probably 72 or 73, was another incident that happened in the valley. It was, and if I could Google, man, I could Google, but I don't know how to put the keywords in there. I'd like to get the time frame within a year.
Okay.
But, so 70, yeah, more than likely I pulled out again around mid-October, November, went to the city, and then headed down to, I'd expanded from Mexico into Central America and South America.
Oh.
And then I, you know, something about the tropics down there, it really reminded me of Nam. And you look at a map, you know, you kind of draw a straight line, and from where I was at, you'd be down like in Nicaragua and such.
Yeah.
From Vietnam to Nicaragua. And I would have came back probably in April. You know, I'd have the call of the mountains hit me in the springtime. I'd stop in San Diego and see my brother for a little bit, and then just head back and get back into the same old routine, which was music, demonstration, and Yosemite.
Okay.
And I was getting better. I mean, I was every year I was getting better. I was getting more comfortable with myself. I was getting more comfortable around people. I was still going down to the corral. Every time I was in the valley, still going down to the corral, feeding sugar cubes to mules.
Had your relationship with Sweet Pea grown in any way, or was it with or any of the other packers there?
Yeah, no, a lot of times there'd be nobody there. I'd just go.
Huh, cool.
You know, just go, and they, a few of them knew me. They knew they were going to get sugar. You know, if they saw me, four or five of them would walk over.
They'd come in. Cool.
But, I think And here's how I left Yosemite. And I think it's 1973, 72 or 73. And I'm at the cabin with Catherine and one other person. And it's probably October. And one evening, first time in the 3 or 4 years I'd been kind of hanging out up there, one evening we hear a voice, and it sounds like they're calling for help. So we go out, and we hear this male voice. He's not far away. So we find him. He was only probably 200 yards from the cabin. And he's a day hiker, and he was basically lost. It's the first time anybody that we hadn't taken down there had showed up. So immediately, you know, kind of going, oh, fuck, you know. So we take him inside and feed him and do all of this, and he seems real nervous. And the next morning, I said, I'm going to take you down to a trail, and I'm going to point you the way to the valley. And through talking and stuff, found out that he was an employee at Curry Village, and he was just out for a day hike, and he was supposed to be to work, and he was going to be in all kinds of freaking trouble. And just, I said, well, you know, I'll take you down to a trail, but I'm going to put a t-shirt over his head, because I didn't want him to be able to find his way back. And it was about a half a mile to the Snow Creek Trail. We take him down there, and I pointed downhill, and I said, about 5.5 miles, you'll be back in the valley. Next day, you know, just went about our business. The next morning, at probably 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, just daylight, we hear helicopters.
Gotcha.
And going, what the fuck? And there was this point about, a quarter mile from the cabin that just opened up, just beautiful granite with the most spectacular view of Half Dome in the valley. And we're still asleep and stuff, and we kind of hear these helicopters. And about 10 minutes after hearing the helicopters, I hear voices. And I come walking down the stairs, and the door flies open, and there's a guy, Eddie Bauer, just dressed to the hilts, and he's got a gun pointed at me. And I raised my hand, and I said, John Muir, not Jerry Rubin. And he said, get down here. And then 5 or 6 other guys were in the door. And they had been told by this guy that was lost, he went into the park offices and said he was damn sure Patty Hearst and the weather people were camped out up at this cabin.
Oh, this was the time of
the weathermen, the weather people.
Yeah.
And there was a Park Service guy there, and there was 5 FBI guys there, and 2 Park Service, and they knew within 2 minutes that, you know, they had the wrong information. So we made coffee, and Park Service guy came over, and said, well, how long you been here? And I don't know his name or anything. I said, well, off and on for three years or so, 3.5 years. And he just kind of shook his head. And then I showed him all the improvements we'd done on the cabin, you know. And we packed in all these shakes, and we dug out this spring here. And he just says, well, you know, you can't stay here. And, you know, it kind of brought, it was a bad moment for me, but it was just the start of another yellow brick road. And they said, you don't have to go right now. You know, maybe we could sign you up as a volunteer or something, and you could stay there. I'm going to just yell at my wife. She's getting, a friend just came up to take her to physical therapy.
Okay.
So let me just say one quick thing.
Yeah.
Okay, Chewy. Have fun today. Girls' Day. Love you.
Okay. I got the rest of the day to myself.
You know, I just want to sort of step in and say, that's just really awesome. You know, thinking about the Stoneman Meadows actions, and then just a few years later to discover, you know, a cabin in the middle of the park, and not to sort of, you know, handcuff all you people and say, don't ever show back up again, for the agency to say, hey, you know, you want to be volunteered, you want to you know, kind of keep your connection to this place. That's just like, wow. That's great. I mean, I can appreciate it wasn't going to work, but the offer, the olive branch offer.
Yeah, I agree. I thought at the time it didn't, you know, register to me as a real nice gesture.
Right.
But, no, I agree. I thought back on that, and I agree. So, I think I spent 4 or 5 days more there, and then headed out to, and I'm sure this was in the fall, and headed back out to San Francisco and made my, I think that year basically, was the first time I ever came to the Big Island. Instead of going to Central America, Catherine and I said, well, let's go to Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we came over here. It was one of our last trips together. We came over here and spent like 5 or 6 months. And, you know, grew a patch and went back to the mainland. And when we got back from here, that's the spring that I went to Idaho. And I'm thinking that's 1973 or... it would have been 74, 73, 74. I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, somewhere in there. That's good. That's good enough.
And I just don't have the memory anymore.
So
okay, now I got to call my dog real quick.
Okay.
Ted, boy. Ted, come on up here with your dad, Ted. Get out up here. Put something in your mouth. That up, boy. You got to stay home.
Good boy.
Come here.
So yeah, I had picked up a hitchhiker, a guy by the name of Kent Stokes. Where are you from? All that stuff you do. And he was the first one that ever told me about Idaho.
Huh.
So I live in Idaho, a place called McCall, Idaho. It's just spectacular.
Hey, Richard. Excuse me for a minute for jumping in. Before we before we move to Idaho, did you ever go back to that cabin? Did you ever check in with the Park Service? Did they incorporate that place? What did they do with it, do you know?
You know, I talked to some people that had been there, and I think at one time they made it what it was made for Curry. They opened it up. They had a volunteer there, and it was for people that were doing multi-day cross-country skiing and such.
Oh, uh-huh.
And that's what I think, is that they stopped, and, you know, I'm not sure.
I might look that up a little bit. It'd be interesting to know, to see if they incorporated it or let it go back to ground again. Interesting.
Yeah, I think maybe in these days it probably, I'm not sure. No, yeah. I never did go back there.
Okay.
I just,
okay.
And I've never really been one to go back. This is an exception here. Like I said, I was here in 73, and that's the year now.
Yeah, no worries. I just,
and I came back, yeah.
Just kind of wanted to tie that up and see how that headed out. So in the spring of 74, maybe, roughly, you ended up driving up to McCall, Idaho.
I ended up hitchhiking to McCall, Idaho.
Hitchhiking, okay.
Yeah. And, yeah, what a place. What an incredible place.
What was it like? I've never been there.
It was a real small town on Payette Lake, and it was just absolutely spectacular, especially in the mid to early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Small town, maybe 2,000 people, surrounded on all sides by what would become, after the Wilderness Act was passed, the Frank Church Wilderness of No Return.
Okay.
I mean, just, it was unbelievable. And
this is Salmon River country.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep, it's, it would be just kind of south of Riggins.
Okay.
It was, yeah, south. North would be Lewiston. It was just beautiful.
Nice.
And the first year there, you know, I was doing odd jobs a little bit, and doing the same thing I did in Yosemite, you know, selling old weed and just trying to get by and lived down on the river in a teepee with, there was about six or seven of us. I was the first Californian in there that anybody remembered. And some of the other guys were, you know, from Boise and came up, and we met a guy that, Bert Walker, mortician, had a nice piece of ground right on the Payette River, just about a mile from town, and he was just super. He said, yeah, you guys can set up a little camp down there and do whatever you want, and, you know, yada, yada. So that was home in Idaho for the first couple of years. But that first year I did my basic thing again, is get out of there in October, November, and go down south. That was still a comfort zone. When I was going through the Bay Area, call my mother, see if I could pop in there for a visit. She'd tell me, yeah, your dad will be working swing shift, so o'clock would be a good time.
Oh, wow.
I'd go have lunch and hugs, and then I'd get out of there before the old man got off work, and then go stay in the city, and then head down south.
Central America area?
Yeah.
Okay.
Another thing you could research is the date. I know it was Christmas Eve. I'm not sure what year. The big earthquake in Managua.
Okay.
Because I was there for that.
All right.
And I was about 7 or 8 miles out of town on, it's called Lake Nicaragua. The epicenter was, and I'd spent Christmas Eve there and scored a little weed. I was traveling with some guys who picked me up hitchhiking from Canada. And we drove out of town because somebody told me, you know, don't get caught with us around here. That
right.
Mosa was the dictator at the time. So anyway, Cliff Notes have nothing to do with the Grand Canyon. We could find the year of that.
Yeah. Okay.
And I came back into town the next morning, Managua, and there was just this, and we felt the quake. It was at nighttime, late at night, and there was just all these refugees and just people pouring around. What the fuck? And Managua was just rubble. And I still had all my medical skills. So I ended up staying there for probably 3 to 4 weeks volunteering, and then just couldn't stand it and couldn't handle anymore. It's another story. It's a story of Somoza and dictators and nothing getting to the people and
All
this aid coming in, and you'd have to buy it on the black market, nothing coming to any of the shelters, any of the relief agencies, any of that kind of shit. It was just absolutely incredible. It was the first time I ever heard the word Sandinista. And when I left there, I headed down to Costa Rica and then Panama. And so anyway, yeah, whatever year that was, and I was, that might have been the first winter after I'd gone to Idaho. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm sorry about being so vague on dates and times.
I couldn't do any better, Richard. If you asked me about what went down in the 1970s, I'd look at you with a big blank stare and go, yeah?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. But that's good. You got Managua earthquake and Christmas Eve. We'll get that time stamp. That'll be easy. Yeah.
So then, I didn't even stop in Yosemite. My next trip up to the mainland, I went straight back to Idaho, and I was just kind of drifting, and I got one friend from Vietnam that, you know, we'd talk every couple of 3 weeks on the phone. And he says, hey, my brother's there. I told him, yeah, I'm just kind of drifting around, doing odd jobs and stuff. He says, why don't you come out to Central City, Colorado? He says, my brothers and I have a business here. He says, we can get you a job. I said, well, fuck, you know? Yeah. Sounds good. It's spend a few months back there. So I go to, again, hitchhiking to Central City, Blackhawk, Colorado, which is kind of in between Boulder and Denver.
Okay.
And these three brothers and a sister and her husband had started this packing business. They had horses and mules.
Ooh.
They had, yeah, they had a little gun store. They had, I'll bet they had 30, 35 head.
Whoa.
Yeah, I don't know how deep I can go into this, but anyway, I'll give you the cliff notes.
Yeah, please.
It was a front for a pretty good size pot business. They would take the mules, and this was what I got trained to do. This is where I learned how to friggin' pack a mule.
Cool.
And ride a horse.
Okay.
Is they would have these Cessnas, sometimes two or three, fly over the mountains where there's no roads and such, and that whole area was just old mines.
Right.
Old mines. And they would kick loose hundreds of pounds of marijuana.
Okay.
And then our job was to pack them up, take them to a mine shaft, and sit guard on them until somebody from Boston brought their U-Haul trailer or a big U-Haul truck. And then we would pack them up again, meet them at a back road, however many miles that was, load their trucks, take the mules back into Central City, run a few friggin' tourist deals until the next load, which could have been anywhere from 2 weeks to a month away, where we would go through the whole shebang again. And I lived with them in their house. Michael and I were tight. He was also a medic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And it was a very unique, wonderfully loving family. They were out of Orlando, Florida, to begin with, and had moved to Colorado 4 or 5 years earlier and started this business. And I was paid. Started at $100 a day, and by the time I left, which again, I left because of a little trouble, I was making $300 a day. That was big money.
It was way big money.
It was big money. And so that's how I learned to pack a mule.
Nice.
And that's how I learned to tie a knot.
Did you ever,
without
going into too much detail, did you ever, like, you know, have a load, like, swing around to the, like, you know, swing off the back of the mule around to its tummy and, you know, have to sort that out as the mule's kind of hopping around? I mean, I would assume you would have learned by some trial and error experience with some difficulties involved how not to get your foot stepped on and bit and, you know how to take care of the animals.
Yep. Yep. No, everything you said was, you know, exactly right. You know, you tie a load on, man. You want to tie it on right the first time. And I learned how to throw a diamond hitch. I learned how to throw a barrel hitch. I learned how to manny the stuff up. I knew how to pack awkward loads, and it was a wonderful on the job training that would last me for the next 30 years.
Wow. And over some
That's
rough...
That's what I was saying early on, you know, about the yellow brick road, and about just following the path, you know. And I don't regret... I know it was against the law, but I don't regret any of it. Because I just followed what was laid there. I made a phone call. The guy says he's got a job for me in Central City. And I was like, well, that's great.
Right.
And then that job turned into a career with the National Park Service. And so I say, I look at the 7 or 8 years after I left Yosemite to the time I got to Grand Canyon. It just amazes me to this day, you know.
I mean, just like how fortuitous, rough terrain, large animals, packing, OJT right there.
Right there. That was it. After feeding them sugar cubes for a few years, talking to them, I always talk to mules. They love to be talked to. They pick their ears up, and they move them around. They look you in the eye, you know.
Nice.
So, yeah, from feeding them sugar cubes to packing 200 pounds of weed a mule. Well, Jerry Garcia said, what a long, strange trip it's been.
Yeah. And so you were able to, kind of leave the job without... you know, burning any bridges with those folks? And
Yeah, I was. The Cliff Notes, or the deal was that there was a little trouble. I think probably about the third or fourth month that I was there. And I was able to zip out. And I had probably 5 or 6 grand more money than I fucking had ever. And I went back to Idaho. And that's when I bought my first animals, my own animals.
Oh, wow.
I bought two horses and a mule. And the high country around McCall area was still snowy. So this is springtime, still kind of snow on the ground. And I had a friend trailer my animals down to the Salmon River. And I'd been in jail a couple times, and I wasn't real sure how all that shit in Colorado was playing out. So he dropped me at a place called the Wind River. It was about 25 miles from Riggins up at that time, the Salmon River Road, gravelly dirt track. And I went across that pack bridge, Wind River Pack Bridge. I set up a little camp because I had been in jail before, and I told myself, you know, if you can't do the time, you shouldn't do the crime. But I had broken the law, and I, you know, could have. So I just didn't want to be anywhere anybody could find me. I had these old, my own animals, man. I dropped off there with a bunch of beans and a bunch of pot and some feed, some cob, and spent 3 days right on a nice little sandbar on the Salmon River.
Nice. And this is upstream from the end of the road. That trail goes all the way up to Salmon City, doesn't it? I mean, a long ways.
The road itself takes off right at Riggins.
Okay.
And dead ends at a place called Vinegar Creek.
Okay.
And that's where now the rafters and stuff take out either at French Creek or Cherry Creek, I mean, or Vinegar Creek.
It's like huge country out there, the Frank Church.
Oh, unfucking believable, bro.
Wow.
Unbelievable. That's absolutely beautiful.
That's a good place to hide out.
Yeah. So I was planning just a long pack trip. And I was getting used to my animals, and they were getting used to me. And the first little trip I took, after 2 or 3 days of camping down on the river, was up the Wind River. And 3.5 miles up the Wind River, I find this abandoned cabin.
Wow.
Exactly like fucking Snow Creek, bro. I mean, the cabin wasn't, but here I am again, man. I see this fucking abandoned cabin.
Huh.
I went back down. I got my camp. I moved up, camped in this meadow. Had Meadow Creek on the back. Had Wind River running by us. This old hand-hewn log cabin.
Wow.
I mean, just absolutely beautiful. So I camped up there for a few days, waiting for snow to melt and all this other shit. Didn't see anybody. And then I took a trip. It had melted. There was still some snow on the trail, but I took a trip, saddled up, and went 3 days to a place called the Shep Ranch that was along the river. You had to either fly into it, or that one you could jet boat, or you would stop there if you were on a river trip going down river. And I met some people there, a guy by the name of Court Conley, who wrote some of the best books on the Salmon River.
Uh huh. Yes.
And he said, well, where are you coming from? I said, man, I found this little friggin' cabin, just 3.5 miles from the pack bridge. And he says, oh, the McMeekin place. I said, I don't know. I said, fuck, McMeekin. I saw a grave down there on the river, says Neil McMeekin. And he says, yeah, it's the old McMeekin Ranch.
Hmm.
That it's probably the only private holdings, in this neck of the woods or in that area and shit. So I went back, and I spent a couple days at the Shep Ranch. They were just gearing up, and I actually did a little work and got paid a little bit. And they asked me if I wanted to help run their mules that they wintered in Grangeville. He says, we come in through the McMeekin and we run them down here. Says we like to have two or three people. They probably had 30, 35 head. And I said, sure. And they said, well, it's going to be in about 2 weeks, and we'll just see you there at your camp. So during that time frame, I went from a friend from a call, I think, came and picked me up. And I went from, somebody's calling. Can you hear that beep?
No.
Okay, good. So I went from, drove up to Grangeville, which was the county seat. And I found the owner and stuff for that property.
Of the McMeekin place.
Of the McMeekin Ranch.
Okay.
Yeah. It was owned by a doctor in Portland by the name of Jack Bell. So I made contact with him, and I told him, I said, "Shoots, you know, I've just been camping in your mess up there, and I said, would you be willing to let me stay there in exchange for some work? I said, I got a little bit of experience doing work on remote cabins." And we reached a deal. He was a super guy.
Nice.
And the only time I met him, he came out after about, I was there about 6 months or something. He came out and I packed him in up there. But anyway, so that place turned in home.
Okay.
It was absolutely unbelievable place. And I did a lot of work there. And I'd work for the river guys now and again. That's where Catherine and I, we had split up not the year before, but when I went to Central City, she went back to San Francisco, and then she came back up for a few days, and I turned into a meat eater, and we just, I'm going to go this direction, and she says, I'm going to go this direction. She says, I'm going to make jewelry and move to Maui. I said, well, I'm going to go up to this, ride my mules, and so I'll finish this off here, because that's going to get me pretty close to the friggin' Grand Canyon.
Yeah, good.
And again, and I apologize to the...
Why? No need
so
to.
I've been there for probably a year and a half, and just hadn't left to head down south or anything. I had kids now, you know, I had animals, I had mules, I had...
Yeah, you had responsibility.
Responsibilities. And I was living like an old trapper or something, you know, which I always had. One of the best books I ever read was called Give Your Heart to the Hawks.
Hmm.
And it was about the old mountain men, Jim Bridger, friggin', you know, all the guys. And it was just like, wow. And I was, to a point, living that life, you know? I mean, I was killing things to eat, butchering them out, fishing. I never did any trapping. I just thought that was inhumane. I was fixing up a cabin. I had all, you know, I had all kind of shit to do. And friends from McCall would come down now and again, and you know, it was just a wonderful place. And I heard about a party that was going to happen in a place called Bergdorf Hot Springs. And road miles from McCall, it was probably 30 miles. And from where I was staying by trail, it was about probably 20 miles, 22 miles.
Couple day ride.
And so, yeah, it's a good ride. It took me 2 days. So I rode up there, and it was a party where, again, just changed my life into the fact that I met this lady, and we hit it off, and she had a 2-year-old daughter, and so we, you know, I stayed up at Bergdorf for a few days, and Lisa and her daughter Heather were staying in a little place in McCall, I went down there for a day or two, and I just absolutely fell in love with the two-year-old.
Oh.
You know, I mean, her mother was a trip, but here's this two-and-a-half-year-old. And my mules had been up at Bergdorf. There's a big pasture around there, and I knew the owner, and it was gay. And I said, well, I need to get back up, and I'm going to head back to where I stay. So he gave me a ride up there. I saddled up, and we said, how about next week? You guys come down to Salmon River, and I'll grab you at the Wind River. They said, that would be great. And the rest is kind of history, as we say. Heather, who's my daughter, we've lasted 47 years. The mother and I lasted maybe three. And it definitely just changed my whole way of thinking. And we were up there together for two years. I would put Heather in a pannier, and then I'd counterbalance the other side, man, and ride her up the trail.
That's some serious packing there. You don't mess.
Yeah.
You don't mess up with that kind of load.
No. And it was a rugged trail. A couple of fords and this, but I spent between Central City and my own animals, and, you know, riding rough time. You know, I'd spent hundreds of miles in the saddle already.
Yeah.
And so they moved in with me.
Okay.
And it lasted until we both started thinking, oh, she's going to have to go to school and such and do this. And we decided we'd head back to McCall. I still had the lease on the place, the McMeekin. So we moved back to McCall. The first season back there, I got a job for the city of McCall, village of McCall, just doing odds and ends labor stuff. And then I saw an announcement for the Forest Service that they wanted, they were looking for trail crew and animal packers.
Ooh.
And that was my in. I got a seasonal job packing out of the McCall district of the Payette National Forest. And the first year was just like packing fire lookouts, picking up smoke jumpers gear after they'd jumped a fire. You know, busy, always busy, remote, you know, long trails. And I was good at it and just absolutely in love with it.
Nice.
And then...
And this is
next year.
This is 1977-ish, 78-ish.
Yeah, probably. That's right. 76, 77. I could ask Heather when we met. But yeah. That's the time frame.
Okay.
And. Second year with them.
Hey, Richard.
With the Forest Service. Yeah.
We've been going at it now about an hour. And,
okay, cool.
Maybe it's a good time, because I would like to spend a little more time with your packing experience. working for the McCall District folks on the payette there. And I don't want to rush through that, if you're okay with that.
No, that's fine.
All right.
That'd be fine.
All right. Well, why don't we wrap up this part three Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Richard Hansen. Today is Tuesday, October 13th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Richard, thank you so very much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, an hour's plenty, bro.
All right, hang on.